Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Lauren Meltzer. Our topic this hour is cooperatives, workers in progress. The UN's dubbed 2012 the year of the cooperatives. In the U.S., there are roughly 30,000 cooperatives comprising nearly 900,000 members. Of these co-ops, somewhere between 300 and 400 are worker cooperatives, where workers own their jobs and the business and have the power to make decisions about where, how, and with whom to do business. Today's worker co-op is arguably not just your hippie grocery store. In the Bay Area, Rainbow Grocery, Design Active Action Collective, Biofuel Oasis, Maybeck High School, Wages, Mandela Foods, Arizmendi Bakery, and Lusty Lady represent some of the new and not-so-new business models that value sustainable growth, social justice, community benefit, and profit. What are the effects are cooperatives having regionally, nationally, and worldwide? Has the politics of the younger generations heralded the new wave of co-ops? And why has the UN dubbed 2012 as the International Year of the Cooperative? Joining me in studio this evening to join this conversation and more are John Curl. John is a writer and historian who has been working in and writing about cooperatives since the 1960s. His most recent book, For All the People, Uncovering the Hidden History of Cooperation, Cooperative Movements, and Communalism in America, will be published in an expanded second edition this summer. John is a professional woodworker and has been a member of the Heartwood Cooperative Workshop Woodshop in Berkeley since its founding in 1974. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Lauren.
We also have Lily Alvarez. Lily is the program coordinator at Wages, Women's Action to Gain Economic Security. She is the primary liaison between the Wages Office, co-op managers, and co-op members. And she plays an integral role in cooperative development, technical assistance, and consulting. Welcome, Lily.
Thank you, Lauren.
And we have also in studio Casper Kochab. Casper is an entrepreneur and member of No Boss, Network of Bay Area Worker Cooperatives, where he currently sits on its board. Casper has been a member of the Berkeley Free Clinic Collective for many years and says his dual interest in business and the study of human cultures makes him a fine fit for worker co-ops. And last, we have by phone Melissa Hoover. And Melissa is, welcome, Casper.
Thank you very much.
And last but not least, we have Melissa Hoover. And Melissa is the executive director of the San Francisco-based U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives, the national membership organization for worker cooperatives. Melissa is also a staff member with the Arizmendi Association of Cooperatives, a group of worker-owned bakeries based in the Bay Area, where she supports the financial management of existing member bakeries and helps plan for the development of new Arizmendi cooperatives. Welcome, Melissa.
Thank you.
And we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. And we'll start taking calls or listening to your email, reading your emails in about 20 minutes. So you can email us also at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So let me start the show with Melissa. Melissa, you're executive director of the San Francisco-based U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives. Can you tell us what is a worker cooperative and how they are similar and different than for-profit and non-profit corporations?
Sure, yeah. A worker cooperative is a business. First of all, that's a really important thing to know about the form. It's a for-profit business with some pretty serious qualifications around that for-profit part. But it is not a nonprofit. It's not a grant-funded entity. It's a business that operates in the market. But it operates for the benefit of its members. It's a specifically mission-driven, value-driven business. And so worker cooperatives are owned by their members and democratically controlled by their members. The democratic control can take any number of forms, but it's the essence of it is one member, one vote. So if we have 10 people who get together to form a cooperative business, our democratic control of that entity boils down to our vote as members. And we also buy in as members and distribute the surplus among ourselves as members. So it's a business form that's intended to create benefit for its members. And it's also, cooperatives are sort of subscribed to a internationally accepted set of cooperative principles having to do with concern for community and autonomy and economic participation. So there's a there are some supports and structures around the cooperative form that, that bind all cooperatives together.
And how big are cooperatives generally?
Well, worker cooperatives tend to be pretty small, small to medium-sized businesses. Worker cooperatives are only one kind of cooperative. There are probably people are more familiar with something like a consumer cooperative, where the members of the cooperative are not the people who work in it, but the people who buy from it. And so things like consumer cooperatives like REI, a lot of the natural foods grocery stores that people around the country tend to shop in, those are consumer cooperatives, and they tend to be larger than worker cooperatives. And then there are farmer and agricultural cooperatives are very large, hundreds of thousands of members. But worker cooperatives, for the most part, tend to be fairly small businesses.
So how does it work in terms of if I just say I am a finance person and I'm really interested in being part of a cooperative, how would I find a cooperative? How long would it take? You know, do you interview for cooperatives the way you interview for other jobs? And I mean, it would seem like you have to be really picky about who you bring on board.
That's true. You do have to be picky about who you bring on board. You know, you're talking about co-owning a business with your coworkers. So as with a lot of things, the cooperative way of doing things looks a lot like the conventional business way of doing things, plus a little bit extra. So you would apply for a job at a co-op. You would interview. You'd probably interview several times. And then once you're hired, you're an employee of that business. And most co-ops, I'd venture to say almost all co-ops, have a candidacy period where you're working for the business, but you're also on a sort of a membership track, figuring out if it's something you want to invest in, and your coworkers are figuring out whether they want you to join them as a member and co-owner of the business. So there's an extra step there usually.
Do generally the people in a small 1 to 10 business, I mean, is it very specialized in terms of, you know, you have, does every person pretty much have its own specialty in the co-op?
You know, co-ops, it really depends on the industry and the business and the people in it. They, you know, the beauty of human diversity is that we can set up any number of systems to meet our needs. And because co-ops are specifically designed to meet their members' needs, they tend to each look a little bit different. But basically, you know, they also tend to follow industry standards. So at Rainbow Grocery, for instance, there are departments and people work in departments and, you know, they function, you know, as a regular business in that sense. Now they have a little bit more flexibility about what you can train to do and where you can move. But a lot of that stuff is just, you know, common sense business structure dictated by the industry and the size of the business. I think there's this myth that in a co-op, everybody does everything, you know, and we all learn and rotate jobs. And there are some co-ops that function that way, but I think the great majority of them do have specialized job roles.
So does everyone in the business, in the co-op business, get paid the same amount, or is it just they get one vote?
Again, it totally varies depending on the co-op. A lot of co-ops do have a flat wage scale. Others, even when they have a differentiated wage, try to adhere to a principle, a low spread, basically, between the highest and the lowest paid person, a principle of parity in compensation. But there are, you know, there are a whole bunch of different ways to do it. The way the surplus is distributed in a co-op, in addition to your wages as a worker, you also get surplus as an owner of the business. That's based on your economic contribution to the cooperative, and in a worker co-op, that's the labor that the co-op is basically buying from you. And so when the surplus is distributed, it's based on, in most cases, based on the number of hours that you worked.
Okay, and then my last question for you, Melissa, is what are the challenges that co-ops face today, worker co-ops face today?
Oh, wow, we could do a...
Okay. What are the top three?
Right, in 60 seconds. I think co-ops face a lot of the same challenges as other small businesses, you know, access to capital, access to technical assistance and support, Where they're not challenged is in customer loyalty and community support. And so when a co-op business runs up against a lot of the same economic difficulties as other small businesses are facing, they may often have stronger community support and the ability of co-owners of the business to do things like avoid layoffs or, you know, choose to do to cut labor in different ways, those kinds of things. So, you know, I think they're sort of garden variety small business challenges. And then there are special cooperative challenges, which is that a lot of professional service providers, attorneys and accountants, don't necessarily know. And then I'm sure we'll spend a lot more time talking about the rest of the challenges.
Okay. Fair enough. Well, let me bring John Curl into the conversation. John, your book, in your book, For All the People, Uncovering the Hidden History of Cooperation, Cooperative Movements, and Communalism in America, you mentioned the hidden history of cooperative movements. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the United States is billed as the bastion of free enterprise and of individualism. And there's a lot of myths built up around that, when in reality, the history of the United States is filled with waves and waves of immigration from all over the world, and each wave of immigration, some of the first things they did were set up cooperative structures among themselves in their you know, that's how they helped each other to. You know, to get settled in this country, you know, as they started moving west, all those wagon trains were really cooperative organizations, and the labor movement started as as mutual aid, and the labor movement was very, very closely involved with cooperatives, and early as industrialism as the industrial system grew in the United States. Most industrial workers really resisted becoming wage earners. They thought they would, you know, maybe be a wage earner for a short period of time, and then, you know, and then just to get enough money to get started on some self-employment. And as industrialism grew, people became what they called wage slaves. So they were never able to get out of they were trapped in the system. And the labor movement, the early labor movement, you know, as exemplified by the Knights of Labor, set the goal and the ideal of the labor movement was to form worker cooperatives to get their members out of wage slavery, and to be the embryo of a new economic system based on cooperation and not on competition.
So why now? Why do you think that the UN has dubbed this the year of the cooperative?
The major reason why the United Nations has turned to cooperatives and asked every country in the world to form an alliance between the government and the cooperative movement is because the world economic system cannot deal with the problems of the 21st century. It's not set up to do that. The capitalist system, in all its variations, it's really quite good at amassing a capital, at gathering capital, but it funnels that wealth into the hands of a small elite, and so with the population continuing to explode, with climate change, what we've got is a situation where there's a larger and larger numbers of marginalized people. And this is setting up a disastrous situation, and the United Nations is asking the countries of the world to look towards their cooperative movements, which are basically, when it comes down to it, is mutual aid, is people helping each other to overcome that, to bring all these marginalized people into the economic system. And there's a lot of resistance to it because because capitalism really is based on funneling wealth to a small elite and not to distributing it to the greater numbers of people.
Now, are there certain countries that would that lend itself more to having an easier time to have co-ops than others?
Well, there's more of a strong tradition of the acceptance of cooperatives in a number of European countries, in Spain, in Italy, and in various Latin American countries. You know, here we had back in the end of the 19th century, there was a you know, somewhat of a class warfare between the labor movement and the rising industrial class. And the labor movement was literally defeated. You know, tomorrow is May Day, and that really marks a great defeat. It's like a watershed of the destruction of the Knights of Labor and their cooperatives. Well, in Europe, that's why they talk about American exceptionalism. Some historians say that American exceptionalism is based on the defeat of the labor movement in 1886, while in Europe. And in most of Latin America, the labor movement and cooperatives were more assimilated into a part of the system rather than thrown out of the system.
Very interesting. Let me bring Kasper Kochab into the conversation. Kasper, you're an entrepreneur and member of No Boss. I love that.
Thank you.
Which kind of focuses on Bay Area cooperatives, correct?
Correct. So No Boss, which is actually NOBAWC, stands for the Network of Bay Area Worker Cooperatives. We just really enjoy to pronounce it as No Boss. came into being in 94 with 7 or maybe 9 founding members, and has grown quite significantly in size as far as paying membership dues workplaces, up to currently between 38 and 40, depending on how many have mailed in their dues for 2012. Friendly reminder. And correct. So we have a three-prong vision or mission statement, I guess you can say. One is to support the existing co-ops that are in our network, as well as beyond our network, who might not be able to afford or are not close enough to actually participate in the membership. It's also to help folks who are wanting to get a business that is structured as a cooperative. And even though we use the, I just want to make a clarification, even though we use the term worker cooperatives, really our mission is to support any democratic workplace. So worker co-ops have also a very specific legal definition in many states, including in California, the Cooperative Corporation Code. So, you know, we partly used it so we can have No Boss as our nickname, and partly because it does encompass really what we're about in terms of a workplace or a worker cooperative representing a institutionalized democratic structure for how the business functions. And then our final third mission is to do programs like this one and do education and outreach to you know, there's very little in our, as John just laid out, in our history books, and even less in our economic books in high school and JCs, universities, that talk about the cooperative model as a legit business model. You know, it's really boiled down to sole proprietorship, LLC, and a corporation. And not only does that limit the possibility for entrepreneurs and people interested in doing business, but it also cuts out a huge portion of the kind of questions that we ask in those classes, since we are such a different model than the ones I just mentioned that are more mainstream. You know, the loss is not only in that we see less worker cooperatives, but also in the kind of questions that we ask in our social studies and our econ classes around what a market system should be about and whose needs it should meet.
How does it work from a tax perspective?
Well, I mean, simply by avoiding the description of, just like there might be a discussion of why a business person might choose a corporation for its many sometimes perhaps questionable benefits of creating a pile of papers into a personhood that has certain rights. To, you know, choosing that entity versus a partnership or a sole proprietorship where all the blame or all the responsibility lies on one person and not some entity. Worker co-ops also have certain legal and financial characteristics about it that might be very beneficial for certain industries and for certain ways that some people choose to do business. And we don't have any discussion of that in our textbooks,
okay,
or very little at least.
If you're just tuning in, this is City Visions, and tonight we're discussing the new wave of worker co-ops in the Bay Area and beyond. My guests are John Curl, writer, historian, and longtime member of Heartwood Cooperative Woodshop in Berkeley, Lily Alvarez, program coordinator at WAGES, Women's Action to Gain Economic Security, Casper Kochab, entrepreneur and member of NoBoss, the network of Bay Area worker cooperatives, and by phone, Melissa Hoover, the executive director of the San Francisco-based U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives. We invite you to call in with your questions and comments. Have you ever considered becoming a member of a worker co-op or a co-op for that matter? And why or why not? The number to call and join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Casper, my next question for you is just in terms of the Bay Area, what sort of sectors do in the Bay Area are the cooperatives here?
Absolutely. So in the United States, unlike in European countries, for example, Mondragon area in Spain and some other areas in Italy, where worker co-ops have a much longer trajectory in their development and history. In the United States, the development, or in the Bay Area at least, the way that I've observed worker co-op development is really individual shops getting going on their own. So groups of people coming together, wanting to do business and deciding that they're going to operate as a worker cooperative.
So people that have the same role, like, you know, a bunch of artists or a bunch of...
Exactly. For example, Cheeseboard as an example, just because that has a very interesting, you know, three-decade example of how they've transformed. You know, it was a couple who owned a shop, sold cheese, and decided that they really loved it and they loved their workers and they didn't want to be bosses. So they sold to everybody who was already their employees, and then they became one of the workers, worker owners. From there, the beautiful story around Cheeseboard is that they were so popular that eventually folks kept on coming to them asking, why don't you guys open in our neighborhood? And their solution was that, you know, we're happy with our size. We don't really want to grow, but we'll help you start your own Cheeseboard, except don't call it Cheeseboard. Call it something else. We want that for ourselves, something special, which is really cute, I think. And that's how Arizmendi Association of Cooperatives happened, now opening their fifth location, I believe, on Valencia Street in San Francisco. That's two stores in San Francisco, one in San Ramon, one in Oakland, and one in Emeryville, all of them independently owned by their worker owners, yet all sharing the recipes from, you know, the original cheese board. Many of the policies and procedures, I'm sure some of the bylaw sections, which is the document that governs how the cooperative functions as an organization and so on, are shared. And on top of it, they have a sixth co-op, which Melissa is a member of, that actually spends full time researching and developing where the next Arizmendi shop will be. So, you know, it's hard to answer your question as far as, you know, what's the mix like. I think in the Bay Area, we're very privileged to have a mix of a whole lot of ways of how worker co-ops, how specific co-ops came about. Everything from, you know, like I said, a couple starting a shop and selling it to folks to, you know, peep show adult women workers unionizing and buying their co-op from former owners because nobody wanted to buy a unionized strip club. So, you know, we have a very colorful, including as well, if I may add, a cult. You know, I don't know if maybe any of the callers want to take a guess as to which of our worker co-ops started as a cult, but in fact did.
It no longer. Tell us?
Maybe we should give it a few minutes, maybe see if we have any co-op nerds out there.
If you're out there, listeners, if you have
Let's just say they're one of the more successful ones
okay.
in town.
You can guess this cult. We don't have a prize for you except publicity for knowing it.
We have a NoBoss poster for you on
a T-shirt. Let me move on to to Lily Alvarez. You are the program coordinator at WAGES, which is a co-op. I assume you're not the cult.
No, we're not the cult.
Okay.
WAGES, which stands for Women's Action Taking Economic Security, is an Oakland-based nonprofit organization.
Oh, so you're not a co-op. Okay.
No, we're not a cooperative. We're a nonprofit organization, and we're dedicated to promoting economic and social well-being for low-income women through cooperative business ownership. So we've established 5 cooperatives. We've emphasized an environmental cleaning technique, which all the cooperatives are part of or partake in. And our mission is to build healthy, dignified work for low-income women.
Okay, so tell us a little about that. How does this work for the women?
So WAGES begins with the forming the cooperative from the initial phases. We start with the market and feasibility analysis, and we provide the organizational framework and legal structure for the cooperatives, and then the cooperatives go through an incubation period, which typically lasts about 2 years. And during this period, WAGES provides technical assistance, business development support, leadership development for members, vocational training, and management services. And this is all part of an intensive training program that WAGES has. And in addition, asset building strategies such as internal capital account, profit sharing, no interest emergency loans, individual development accounts, and banking and financial literacy. And then finally, they'll enter a mature phase where they'll continue to receive ongoing network support as part of the network of cooperatives.
So generally, do women come to you? I mean, how does it work in terms of, do you approach people? Do they approach you? I mean, it would seem like not very many women cleaning would be aware of your organization.
Yeah, or of the cooperative model.
Yeah.
So the way we find women to join the cooperatives through referrals of current co-op members. If we're going to start a new cooperative, we actively recruit by partnering with other community organizations who are part of this community that we help.
Is it typical for the kind of women that join the co-ops, are they all the same, you know, they all do the same kind of work, or?
Yeah, all the 5 cooperatives are eco-friendly cleaning cooperatives.
So they all are.
Yeah, they all are.
And that's pretty unusual. I mean, generally the people I think of when I think of people that are doing cleaning work are kind of like constantly trying to find helpers, and you know, it's just a really hard profession. How have you seen people change their lives through this?
Well, I think the eco-friendly cleaning is definitely one of the bigger aspects, because a lot of these women come from, a lot of them did similar work in prior work, but this is life-changing in the sense that they're no longer engaging in toxic cleaning. It's a lot better for their health, for their children, and it's also empowering through the other training support that we provide. There's indirect impact that we've seen. A lot of their kids have been going to college, and yeah, it's a great model for low-income women and low-income people in general.
Wait, let me just give a station announcement, and then I'll go right back to you, Casper. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're discussing the new wave of worker co-ops in the Bay Area and beyond. My guests are John Curl, writer, historian, and longtime member of the Heartwood Cooperative Woodshop in Berkeley, Lily Alvarez, program coordinator at WAGES, the Women's Action to Economic Security, Casper Kochab, entrepreneur and member of No Boss, a network of Bay Area worker cooperatives, and on phone, Melissa Hoover, the executive director of San Francisco-based Federation of Worker Cooperatives. And we invite you to call in with your questions or comments. We're curious, do co-ops feel different? Have you ever gone into a store or done business that maybe at any of the places that Casper was talking about? Do they feel any different to you as a shopper? And also, can you answer or have any have any idea about the co-op that started as a cult? That was Casper's challenge to listeners. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisions.org. StoryVisionsRadio.com. Casper, did you want to?
I'm just realizing I'm probably perpetuating the kind of stereotype that I'm coming on the radio show to really try to dispel. And that worker co-ops are not, as the introduction said, you know, your hippie grocery store. Even though I love the hippies and everything that the hippie movement brought to us. But, you know, moving on with my answer that I started earlier, as far as kind of where are worker co-ops in the Bay Area coming from, I think Wages is a beautiful example of some of the newest models that we're seeing where mission-driven nonprofits are harnessing their potential to create not just programs that are run on grant funding that is very sporadic, but rather on creating jobs that are going to be there forever in those communities. And not only is that empowering in a financial, economic sense for those families, but also having been on a number of panels with the women from the green cleaning co-ops, it's also really beautiful to see how incredibly empowering it is on a political level and a community leadership level. So having, you know, it's five green co-ops, but I think together it adds up to almost 100 members, 100 women among those five co-ops. That's a really significant, not to mention that, you know, the cleaning supplies are greener, but also the pay is much better than they would be getting in for the kind of work that they're doing, you know, in the marketplace. So another program along those lines is Teamworks in San Jose that also focuses on immigrants. And in addition to green cleaning co-ops, they also develop green lawn care services, which is more of a male-focused profession in the Latina immigrant community, which I think is very interesting. And I'm hearing that the Asian community in Oakland is starting to organize women who work in nail salons, where the chemicals are also extremely toxic, to start worker co-ops, women worker co-ops, who will be providing non-toxic nail polish.
You know, I mentioned, I kind of threw out to the listeners to find out if they could feel the difference. But let me ask you all, I mean, or maybe we'll start off with you, Lily. I mean, do you think that the consumers can tell the difference between, you know, from a worker cooperative, the kind of worker cooperatives that you create versus using other eco-safe cleaning services?
Yeah, I think it's a worker cooperative is a, getting work from that is a, it's something that people feel good about. You know, if I were going to have a cleaner, I'd feel much better if she was owning her business and she was sharing all the profits in that business. I think it's a, it really makes a lot of economic and social.
Okay. And sense. Well, and let me go back to you, Melissa. Do you have any say in terms of that from a consumer standpoint?
Well, I think I mentioned earlier, I think that consumer loyalty and the community investment, sometimes financial, but oftentimes, you know, sort of in more abstractly, in worker co-ops is what has helped sustain several of our members through this economic downturn. And I think that's because people feel a connection. They feel a human connection with the people who are working there at retail co-ops in particular. And then there are other kinds of co-ops in other sectors, in manufacturing and in service sector jobs, where the ownership, the members' ownership over of the business and their ownership over their jobs substantively contributes to their ability to do the job better, right? So in care jobs in particular, in home health care, which is one of the growing sectors of worker cooperatives, there's a lot of research that the less alienated the worker is from the job, the more invested, the better they do at it, and that really shows in the home care cooperatives and the longer relationships between caregivers and their patients and the consumers of those services. So I think, you know, there's some academic research out there. There's a professor at the University of Massachusetts who studies the care cooperatives. But then there's also people's sort of everyday experience of walking into a cooperative workplace where the sense of ownership and the joy in being there is palpable. I mean, you really can feel the difference.
Yeah. Let me go to our first caller for the evening. We have Lawrence from Berkeley. Good evening, Lawrence.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Thank you for calling City Vision.
Yeah, hi, John, and how everybody else? How are you?
Hi, Lawrence.
Good. I just wanted to say that I think it's time for a reincarnation of the Knights of Labor. And
why do you say that?
Okay, the reason is this, that there, the two principles of the Knights of Labor was, first of all, local organizing. They wouldn't organize a local that would be all across the country, or, you know, a local that would be in five states. They would organize in one city, and everybody, you know, whatever job it was, would belong in that city. And the second thing, of course, was that they promoted co-ops. And the reason that it's time for that, well, the labor movement has declined so radically that now, after being, you know, 35% of the labor force in the 50s, it's now 7% of the private labor force. And the reason for that, in addition to, you know, the anti-labor laws and whatnot, is that the labor movement is completely out of touch with what kind of labor force exists now in the 21st century, which okay. means that something like 80% of all the workers are in, quote, service industries.
I'm curious, how do you know so much about this?
I read.
Oh, you read, okay.
Among other things, I read John's book, utterly fantastic.
Well, let me just, unless do you have a specific additional question?
Let me finish this development, if I may. When you have service workers, you know, people that are in stores, in schools, in hospitals, the primary characteristic is that they're in touch with the community all the time, unlike an industrial worker who sits in the factory and doesn't talk to the community, doesn't see them. So therefore, organizing has to be done in cooperation with the local community.
Mm.
And is another reason, too, is that nowadays, in the days of globalization, they can send any job pretty much overseas. They can't send the customers overseas. And so they can fire the workers, but they can't fire the customers.
That's true. Wait, I really appreciate this call. You've brought up a lot of interesting points. Let me throw this at you, John. And do you have any... I'm sure you've done a lot of thinking about this.
Well, you know, recently I've heard from various people in the labor movement that that there is a beginning to rethink organizational structures. And the Knights of Labor were really organized on a territorial basis. They were not, although they did have trade unions, they were organized by a community. So that you did not have to be in a particular trade to be a part of that, to be part of the Knights of Labor, and there are labor unions who are beginning to think that that is the way for the labor movement to move. It has to become more of a movement of communities, and you know the United Steelworkers have formed an alliance with the Mondragon cooperatives in Spain, the United Steelworkers Union, which is the largest union in the United States, are in order to revitalize, particularly on what they call the Rust Belt, Midwestern former industrial towns, where the industries have left, that they're working very hard to form an alliance between communities, nonprofits. You know, and internationally now, what they have called social enterprises. So, there is the cooperative movement now is really different than it was back in the 1970s when I started getting involved, which was everybody's kind of on their own. Now the cooperative movement, it's more wages is a really good example that there are nonprofit organizations all over the United States with a social mission, with social justice mission, who are turning to organizing cooperatives, and it's a backup. So the working people often don't have the experience, they don't have the knowledge, they don't know how to go into business, but to have the backup of nonprofits, to have the backup of governmental agencies in certain situations, and of the labor movement. It creates an infrastructure in which working people who want to get out of the wage system who want to get into a democratic workplace, which is really most people, if they most, a lot of people don't have any experience in a democratic workplace. And because it's, you know, it's just kind of not part of most people's American experience. But, you know, it is within the grasp, where it's becoming within the grasp of people now.
If you're just tuning in, this is City Visions, and tonight we're discussing a new wave of worker co-ops in the Bay Area and beyond. My guests are John Curl, who you just heard from, who's the writer and historian and longtime member of Heartwood Cooperative Woodshop in Berkeley, and Lily Alvarez, program coordinator at WAGES, the Women's Action to Gain Economic Security, Casper Kochab, an entrepreneur and member of NoBoss, the network of Bay Area worker cooperatives, and by phone, we have Melissa Hoover, the executive director of the San Francisco-based U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives. We'd love to hear your questions or comments. The number to call is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Caspar?
Just wanted to make a quick comment as far as what Lauren's brought up on the phone, and also kind of seeing where the new trends are in worker co-op development. I think the tech environment in the Bay Area, we've also seen a lot of growth, including a free downloadable PDF for how to start a tech worker cooperative that was put together by a number of co-ops around the Bay and throughout the nation. Techie folks, as you can imagine, often do a lot of freelancing, and they're, you know, I don't want to say lone wolves, but a lot of them have that specialty and can create jobs for their own from project to project. Well, many of these folks are coming together in order to market their services. One has design, the other one has coding C, C+, CMM. I have no idea what they all stand for, but, you know, bringing these talents together and branding themselves as a cooperative and as a business have a much greater pool for having a consistency in consumers, in clients, that is, and also being able to do more diverse tech projects.
Do you think people in the tech world are taken less seriously if they're a cooperative than a company?
That's a really interesting question. I think in general, some people are going to take co-ops not as seriously, and that's because of the stigma and stereotypes that are still out there. But I think not to mention the lack of understanding of what really a worker cooperative is. So it really, if you're talking about finding angel capital and financing a startup, if that's what you're getting at, yes, perhaps it might be a little, maybe not as strategic to market yourself to venture capitalists as a worker cooperative. At the same time, these venture capitalists are really smart people looking for talent, and a lot of this talent can make radical demands of how they function. In fact, as you can see, a lot of multinational and large corporations actually implement principles that are part of the cooperative business model. Things like profit sharing, things like more flexible schedules. These are components of the cooperative business model that have been adapted because they work and they produce better results at the end. So, you know, there's almost kind of like an implicit acknowledgement on the part of these executives that some of this really makes sense. But then there's a line, because if it was to take much further, it would also mean how much of the profits do they have to share with those people producing those profits for them.
Sure.
So it's a very, you know, very touchy balance that happens there.
Now, you never use the word capitalism. Why is that?
Oh, I do all the time, actually.
Okay.
I think what I try to sometimes explain in my, worker cooperatives and cooperatives in general, I've experienced that as a conversation stopper for certain people, just like as I've experienced the word capitalism be a conversation stopper for certain folks. And so what I like to talk, when I talk about co-ops, I like to think of it in terms of a market economy, a market system where we like to trade goods and services. And, you know, worker co-ops are just practical, in my opinion, answer to how do we shift the system from inside out? How do we start shifting the paradigm from one where really the capital is in power to using capital as part of the equation, but really putting people and the workers that produce that capital in the center of the equation? So that's kind of what I feel, you know, people, some folks want I don't want to say want, but imagine, you know, violent revolutions. I imagine a very peaceful, silent one that happens from workers buying out their workplaces, from nonprofits starting jobs that, you know, workers own and can pass on within their communities. And the model's there, and it's a very diverse model. There are worker co-ops that are very flat, more of a collective style where folks... Everybody that's a member also sits on the board, and most of the decision-making happens throughout the workday and throughout the week with maybe an occasional all co-op board meeting once a month or once a quarter, to much more complex structures like Rainbow, where each independent department is its own collective, yet everybody in the store elects two governing bodies, the Storewide Steering Committee and the Board of Directors, who are entrusted with making the financial and legal decisions for the co-op. So, you know, to all the way to Alvarado Street Bakery, for example, where there it's, again, a much more hierarchical structure. But at the end of the day, all the workers vote for the board of directors and entrust that these leaders who have the industry experience and the know-how will make sure that everybody goes home with a paycheck and has the kind of jobs that they feel satisfaction from.
Let me take an email. We have an email comment from Jay, who says the Other Avenue Foods in San Francisco, a worker cooperative since the 1970s, is so beloved by their loyal customers that their customers provided a microloans that allowed them to buy their building a few years ago. Is that common?
I don't know how common it is. I don't know how much we can
really... I think we've heard a lot about this, like, loyal from you and Melissa.
Absolutely. It's just, it's hard to you know, put these practices into any sort of, like, quantitative understanding, because the worker co-op sector is so tiny in the United States. The interest in it is rising very much so. But, you know, certainly in the Bay Area, where we do have some successful worker cooperatives, with Rainbow really leading the way, they've been very generous with the kind of financial support they give. So both from the consumers, but also from co-ops, from within the worker cooperative community, there's often very either 0% loans or very low interest loans for co-ops that need assistance. So it happens, absolutely.
Let me ask, go back to Melissa. You know, one of the challenges I know you've talked about is scale, you know, about scale and challenges reaching it. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. I think that it's a sort of multifaceted challenge. For the smaller co-ops that do make decisions using direct democracy, there's sort of an innate check on size built into that decision-making system. Over, I think the research is something over 25 people tend to break down using direct democracy or consensus-based decision-making. So,
break down in what sense?
Well, you just can't have a consensus process with a group larger than 25. It's not effective. And so what you see in a lot of the larger co-ops is they'll either grow small. They sort of, you know, have, like, Rainbow divides itself into several smaller departments so that those departments can use direct democracy still. And then at the larger sort of entity level, they'll have a representative democracy with a board of directors, or reserve only some of the votes for members, and then other decisions are delegated to departments. So I think that there are complex systems for decision making. Worker cooperatives have developed really sophisticated ways, actually, of creating democratic participation within their businesses. But I think if you go outside the workplace itself, the challenges of growth and scale are that it's really difficult to compete in mm-hmm. an economy like ours, you know, unless you're a massive, massive multinational corporation. And so if you're small and boutique and local, you may have an advantage there. But as soon as you begin to grow beyond that, it can be very difficult. It's hard to get capital and credit. And I think we're just now figuring out how to take outside investment into worker cooperatives without sacrificing that democratic control. And one of the largest worker cooperatives, well, the largest worker cooperative in the world, is based in the Mondragon region of Spain. And one of their articulated principles is the subordination of capital to labor, which means that the workers control the money. And I think we're just figuring out how to do that in the U.S., how to take investment into our enterprises but retain member control and member benefit. Equal Exchange, one of our larger worker cooperatives in the country, is a fair trade coffee importer, and they have outside investors, and they've sort of pioneered the model. So I think, you know, money and financing is always a problem. And then I think it's, you know, it's difficult to, people are difficult, business is difficult, and democracy is difficult. You know, when you put all those things together, there it's just sort of innately challenging. But
is there like a life, lifespan of a typical cooperative, you know, from inception to when they, a lot of them, I'm sure, kind of, to your point, won't function as well once they hit some of the challenges you've talked to.
Yeah, you know, I'd like to speak to that, actually, because I actually think that if and when cooperatives sort of master the appropriate democratic structure for their form, they're businesses that can last a very long time. You know, there are a lot of worker cooperatives, and this is true sort of throughout history. John can probably speak to this better than I can, that last for one generation, you know, because a cooperative is a business form that exists to meet its members' needs.
Mm-hmm.
And so if those needs are fulfilled and that institution isn't, you know, really institutionalized, then it goes away. But the ones that do survive tend to thrive, actually. I mean, we have 40- and 50-year-old cooperatives in this country lasting much longer and you know, having sort of a greater sense of perpetuity than a lot of small businesses. And, in fact, cooperative, you know, worker-owner purchasing of small businesses, one of the ways that we can think about, you know, relieving the pressure on retiring owners and actually keeping those businesses around. So I think, you know, I mean, I think there's sort of things at both end of the spectrum, the single generation cooperatives, but I also see a lot of very long-lived cooperatives that have managed to figure out a way to transfer, you know, their knowledge down through the generations of owners.
Let me take another email. We have an email from Samantha who asks, what about governments? Are they threatened or supportive, and why? I don't know, John, if you want to take that.
Well, right now in Richmond, California, the government, the municipal government, has hired a particular person to organize cooperatives, to help organize cooperatives as an economic development strategy. And you know, the history of governments has been it's really checkered. It's sometimes they've been the enemies of cooperatives, and sometimes they've helped cooperatives. The New Deal did both. The New Deal was tremendous in terms of farmer, rural cooperatives. Most of the United States became electrified and got water through cooperatives. Rural America, before the New Deal, was kerosene lamps and outhouses, through cooperatives and irrigation through rain. You prayed for rain. The New Deal brought through cooperatives. Created a tremendous transformation in the country. Yet the New Deal also drew the line at worker cooperatives. The industrial establishment was too threatened by worker cooperatives. So they basically drew the line at just supporting rural cooperatives, and they did really nothing for cooperatives in cities.
Do you think that today's government would feel a similar threat, or do you think that it sort of evolved?
Well, like I said earlier, I think there's now worldwide pressure. The United States, it will vary from place to place, but there is growing worldwide pressure for the government to form an alliance with cooperatives, because we have the current economic system really cannot deal with poverty. It cannot deal with increasing marginalization. It cannot deal with the somewhat permanent economic disaster that we have in this. I think the depth of this recession really hasn't hit us yet. But the choice is either having a permanent and growing underclass of excluded people, or the government finding some ways to support and to encourage mutual aid rather than to discourage it.
If I could just add to the question around governments and supporting it. In terms of cooperatives, I think it's really important to make this distinction between cooperatives as a whole, as an idea for a organizational model, and worker co-ops in specific. I think when the support from governments or agencies tends to wane is when we start talking about issues of labor relations. And worker co-ops really put the whole idea of an employee contract, employee-employer relationship on its head. And a lot of agencies have no idea how to deal with it. You're an owner and a worker? What? You know, so we bring a certain level of challenge, I think, to some regulatory agencies and also to people who like to talk about financing and who owns what property and whatnot and how that plays out legally.
Let me pause for a second because I'm really curious from Lily's perspective. I mean, you have people that are joined by their mutual wanting to be their own boss and, you know, but have this talent in terms of the cleaning and have this now new kind of spin on what they can do. But do they want to be business people? I mean, do they, by being kind of owners, are they then now thrown into needing to be a business person and not just doing their job? And is that sort of a prerequisite if you want to be in a co-op like this? You do have to have those kind of business chops.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when recruiting for co-op members, we do look for specific skills, and it's not necessarily for everyone. But being an owner and a worker at the same time provides a lot of benefits. We hear a lot, flexibility is an important thing for them. They have more time to spend with their children, stability of work, benefits that maybe in the past they didn't receive in a previous employment. So it's it comes with a lot of different perks for sure.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, we're coming to the top of our hour. I do want to give everyone a chance to say some final word, and I want to make sure, Casper, that you include in your final word the answer to the question you put out there about the cult. So, John, why don't we start with you?
Well, the United Nations has made a study of a comparison of capitalist enterprises as opposed to cooperative enterprises worldwide during the Great Recession that we're still in the middle of. And worldwide cooperatives have fared much better than private enterprises for their workers, because when times get tough, cooperatives really do not lay off their workers to increase the profits of shareholders. It is the welfare of the workers themselves which is the main purpose of the cooperatives. So workers get together and find ways, creative ways to help each other during hard times.
Okay. Great. Thank you. And Melissa?
Okay. Well, I think we're in the middle of a very exciting shift in who's interested in the form and what they're interested in it for in the United States. And, you know, whereas previously we may have seen worker cooperatives as a way to build an economic alternative or exit the mainstream economy, I think now people are seeing it as a form that will help them enter the economy and gain some economic power within the larger system. And that's what excites me about worker cooperatives.
That is very exciting. Lily, what about you? Any final remarks?
I see this cooperative business model incredibly empowering to the women that we serve. And I think that, you know, it's not just for low-income folks, but folks all around across the board, people coming out of college, it's something to really consider, especially in these hard economic times. So,
thank you. And Casper?
Sure, I'll save my 30 seconds to invite everybody to march with us tomorrow. We meet at for the general strike, as it's being called, by the Occupied Wall Street, tomorrow at Fruitvale BART station in Oakland, around 2:45. We'll be marching from them to a park and then to downtown Oakland. And also make sure to check us out at facebook.com/worker co-ops.
And who's the cult?
And the cult, and you can read more about them, now a multi-million dollar, very successful 250-some member worker owners, Rainbow Grocery.
Wow, okay. Well, that's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were John Curl, writer, historian, and longtime member of Heartwood Cooperative Woodshop in Berkeley, Lily Alvarez, program coordinator at WAGES, Women's Action to Gain Economic Security, Casper Kochab, entrepreneur and member of NoBoss, Network of Bay Area Worker Cooperatives, and Melissa Hoover, the executive director of the San Francisco-based U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives. Thank you so much to all of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Laura.
And for a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, you can go to our website at kalw.org, and then look up City Visions. You can look that up, and you will find us. Our engineer this evening was Eric Jansen. Thank you so much, Eric. And tonight's program was produced by Lisa Denmark. Great show, Lisa. City Vision's senior producer is Susie Britton, and Neil Fries manages our website. Join my co-host, Joseph Pache, next week when we'll discuss the controversial multi-billion dollar proposal for a canal to move water south around San Joaquin-Sacramento River Delta. This is Lauren Meltzer. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great week.